I cannot convey any better the traumatic words that you'd hear on this 911 tape. And when I hear them today, my blood runs cold.
911, what's your emergency?
I need an ambulance. My daughter's dying, I think.
Rescue is needed. 3-year-old female child, unconscious, not breathing.
He is wasting away a life in a jail for a murder he didn't commit, and worse, for his own daughter, with whom he loved.
There is a whole bunch of evidence now that links Masuk to the crime scene.
There is absolutely no evidence of any forced entry, any breaking in, and according to the defendant, the only people in that house with permission were himself and Christina.
This is Suspect Convictions. I'm Willis Kern, along with Suspect Convictions creator and investigative journalist Scott Reeder. Just who is Barton McNeil? We know him as a man convicted of murder who maintains his innocence. He stands accused of killing his 3-year-old daughter, Christina, a child he says he loved and would never harm. He has spent the past 19 years locked up in Illinois' maximum security prisons. But just who is Barton McNeil? He says he has many friends behind bars, reads constantly, and isn't allowed to have a prison job because he has been convicted of murder. For nearly 2 decades, his life has been on hold. But what was he like before he was charged with this crime? Barton McNeil's friends describe a young man who grew up in a middle-class home in Bloomington, Illinois. His father was an art professor at Illinois Wesleyan University. His mother died when he was young. He has one brother, Brett. According to his aunt Jean Ross, Brett and Bart are named after the main characters in the popular 1960s TV show Maverick.
Maverick is the name, wild as a wind in all.
That was my sister's favorite television show. She named her kids after them.
Maybe you could tell me a little bit about your sister, Bart's mother.
My sister's Carol was his mother. She was divorced and had 2 children, Brett and Bart, and they were only about 6 and 4 years old when she committed suicide. Oh, that is up for debate. Parts of our family think that she actually had an overdose from drugs because she was being treated by psychiatrists and doctors for stomach problems and depression. And they didn't know much about a lot of the psychological problems that they know about today. She was a very vivacious, beautiful person, my older sister. She was very talented in art and music and dancing, ice skating, you name it. She was, you know, I call her the star of the family. But unfortunately, she married a man who was very, didn't have much of an emotional life. And it was kind of a mismatch for her, but she was only a very young woman when she married him. So he divorced her, and she had 2 children, Brett and Bart, and she moved to Appleton, Wisconsin to be near her parents. And she got a job as teaching art. It was very tragic when she finally did pass away, and she passed away from a preponderance of drugs that she took that day. But Bart was there when she passed away, and he was not permitted to go to the funeral either because the father came back into town, and the father was going to be remarried within a week, and that probably had something to do with my sister. If she did commit suicide, it might have had something to do with the fact that she would now lose her husband forever because he was going to marry somebody else.
Larry Mize, a friend of the family, says it was a rocky relationship between the 2 boys and their new stepmother.
Bart's dad had remarried, and his stepmom was, quite frankly, she was just a fucking bitch. She was not very nice to Bart, and probably not very nice to Brett.
And Bart says his relationship with his father was a difficult one as well.
Well, he just died, as you know, about 8 or so months ago. He was a very, stoic, unemotional kind of person, very quiet all of the time. After he divorced my mom, my brother and I moved up to Appleton to live with our mom, or she moved up there to live near her parents. And after she died, my brother and I went back down to Bloomington to live with my dad. Who, by the way, was an art professor at Illinois Wesleyan University for about 10 years, from approximately 1965 to the mid-1970s. And ironically, we lived on the very same block that Christina later died on, except it was on Prairie Street rather than Evans Street. Evans is one block east of Prairie, so that's sort of an odd irony there. But so after sometime in the late 70s, he and my mom moved to New York City. By then, I sort of went off on my own, and I stayed in the Bloomington area and visited them on occasion in New York. They bought some property in upstate New York also. They lived in New York City for a while, then they bought some property in upstate New York, visited them a couple of times there also. And the next time I saw them was when my dad came down and attended my trial. And after that, after I was convicted, I never saw or heard from him again.
Does that strike you as odd?
Yeah, it does. I'm pretty bitter about the whole darn thing, too, to tell you the truth. And I'm even more bitter that nobody has reached out and, you know, even notified me, you know, that my dad has died. Now, we didn't have any kind of falling out or anything like that either. It's not like, you know, we were estranged from each other. But once I caught this case, so to speak, and I'm sort of reaching out to him and my brother and my stepmom and, you know, like, hey, you know, if you could help me out a little bit here, you know, not paying for a lawyer necessarily, but, you know, in some way, you know, look some stuff up on the internet about, you know, forensics or something. I couldn't get any kind of help from them at all. And the only thing I got from them basically is, you know, keep quiet, quit making this noise about Masuk, and let your public defender handle it because he's going to do a good job. And when I was found guilty, he came to the jail and visited me one last time and was sort of like, don't call me, you know, I'll call you, or some, you know, words to that effect. I thought I misunderstood him. I thought I was reading the signs wrong. And sure enough, a few months later, when I was in Stateville prison, you know, I'd sent him a couple of letters and attempted to call him, finally accepted my call, and it was pretty clear that he was not really eager to continue relations with me.
Well, Scott, it seems pretty clear here that Barton McNeil's immediate family, those who knew him the best, really didn't want anything to do with him, while those who were more distant from him, they seem to want to draw closer to him. That's a weird dynamic, it seems.
You know, yes and no. I mean, his grandmother remained faithful to him all the way through. She was convinced he was innocent from all the way through. I find it curious that these two distant relatives who either barely knew him or didn't even know he existed became involved and became his biggest advocates. But what's curious to me is his father, his stepmother, and his brother really have not had anything to do with him. In fact, his father died, I think, in the last year, and nobody even bothered to tell him. He didn't ended up finding out secondhand. I mean, there's just things like that that are curious to me. I can tell you as a parent, I can't fathom not choosing to be deliberately estranged from one of my children, no matter what they were accused of doing. I just can't fathom that. But I know you've had a lot of experience, Willis, visiting prisons as part of a ministry. And are you at all surprised by this?
Well, I'm like you. I can't fathom totally cutting off my children no matter what happens between the two of us. That's a foreign concept in my mind. But as you mentioned, I have, through volunteer work, gone into prison and had contact with prisoners who've committed some pretty serious crimes. And I have seen a lot of instances where they're just left out in the cold. I mean, years go by and these people don't get any phone calls from anybody. They don't get any visits from anybody. The outside relatives or friends, through some sort of problems they have with the person or just the status that they're a convicted criminal, they just don't want anything to do with them. I think that's pretty common.
Yeah, I understand. But I think about the person who we profiled and looked at for the first season of Suspect Convictions, Stanley Liggins. He was a career criminal. He'd done time at Parchment Prison for armed robbery. He got convicted of murder in the Quad Cities. Now, there's some questions as to, you know, guilt or innocence in that case, but one can say pretty safely that he lived a pretty rough life. And yet, when you read his mother's obituary, he was identified as one of the children there. His mother would visit him at prison. His brother keeps contacting him and calls him up. I mean, that relationship has remained despite being incarcerated for almost his entire adult life, and he's in his mid to late 50s now. So it can go either way, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, I think you're correct. I think that it just depends on the certain circumstances involving each person who's committed the crime or accused of committed the crime, and each person who is a relative or an associate with them before they go in. It's like fingerprints. Everybody's different. So
yeah.
There's no one-size-fits-all, I think, on whether or not someone is going to be a loner in prison or if they're going to have a lot of outside contact with people. I just don't think that's something that happens. We do know a little bit about Bart's childhood, and he did have some problems along the way. In fact, according to his friend Larry Mize, when he was a teenager, Bart actually dropped out of school, and the two of them shared an apartment.
We kind of bordered between the nerds and the stoners, you know? That's really about where we were. We were the pot-smoking nerds, basically.
While Bart did drop out of high school, his friend Larry Mize says he is intelligent.
I thought his dad was a professor there in Normal. I thought his stepmom also had something to do with the university. They were all, you know, pretty intelligent, well-educated people. Even Bart is really a pretty sharp guy. I know that he had taken some college courses and furthered his education, later on in life. He was very much into computers, had the first home computer that I ever touched, you know, old Tandy computer that you had to hook up to your television. And he was kind of into that, you know, stayed on the cutting edge of all of that stuff back in the 90s.
When police searched Bart's apartment shortly after Christina's death, they recovered a small amount of marijuana. Bart admits the pot was his. In fact, according to Andy Nolan, Masuk Nolan Wang sought him to plant marijuana on Bart. So, Scott, it's not uncommon for criminals who are convicted of serious crimes to have some sort of history of more or lesser crimes in their background. And we've heard about Barton's drug use. And this whole concept of Masuk trying to plant marijuana on him or have that seem like it was planted on him. Tell us a little bit about that whole situation there.
Well, I interviewed Andy Nolan, her husband at the time. She was having this relationship with Bart, but she was still legally married to Andy. It's weird. It's kind of complicated. But Andy has told me, and I apparently in testimony has also said, that she called him that night. Now, mind you, Andy's the guy who's been her advocate or defender in this mix, but he said she called him that night and wanted that they broke up, you know, the night where Christina's believed to have died, and wanted him to help her plant marijuana in Bart's car to get him into trouble. And it's like, wait a minute here. Okay.
And this happened on the same night that Christina has died,
yeah,
apparently, right?
Which is like, this is a red flag to me. The defense all along has said that Bart was set up and that the murder was really committed by Masuk. Well, we have somebody testifying that was married to Masuk who says, well, she called me up and wanted me to have me help her set up Bart for drug possession. Well, okay, it didn't happen. But if that's true, she was talking about setting up Bart for something that night already. I mean, that strikes me as kind of weird.
Well, it seems to me like it's a legal red flag, because here is Bart accusing Masuk of basically trying to set him up or frame him through the testimony of Andy Nolan. So, yeah, it seems to me like that's a huge red flag that maybe she took it a step further and decided that, well, if you're not going to do this, or that marijuana is not going to be framed or not going to be planted on Bart, then I'll have to take other actions.
I don't know.
Is that conceivable? Is that a conceivable?
I just think it's weird that, I think the whole thing's weird. If this is true, that what Andy told me, who calls up their husband who you've been cheating on to try to set up the guy that you've been cheating with? I mean, it's just weird. I mean, the whole thing is just weird. I don't know.
After all the episodes we've had, there's only one answer to that question, and apparently it's Masuk.
I haven't heard if she denies that this happened or not, but I think it's curious.
Meanwhile, Scott, as we head back into Bart's past, he marries a woman who's a Filipina lady. This is the mother of Christina.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's an interesting relationship. Bart says they were pen pals for a couple of years. She was working as a midwife in Saudi Arabia, but they seemed to hit it off. She was several years older than him. he visited her in the Philippines, and they got married. But one of the questions that comes to my mind is, Tita is a midwife working in Saudi Arabia. She's got a fair amount of education. And what's drawing her to this guy who's working in a kitchen in Red Lobster in Bloomington, Illinois?
Meanwhile, Bart went ahead and married Tita, and his friend Larry Mize didn't really think it was a hot thing for him to do.
Exactly.
I totally disapproved of this, and I told him so. But he had flown over to the Philippines, I believe it was, and selected himself a wife. I just told him what I thought of it, and I thought it was bullshit. There's plenty of single girls here in America, you know? This is just my synopsis of all of this. I've never been there. I don't really know, but I suspect they're all waiting there at the airport. Hey, Joe, love you long time, you know? Pick me. You know, so he meets this gal over there and brings her back. Here, they get married.
But Bart disputes this characterization, and Tita McNeil has declined to be interviewed.
She was not a mail-order bride by any stretch. It is true that I went to the Philippines, and I went there twice, and I did end up marrying her. But she was working in Saudi Arabia when I first began writing to her at the suggestion of a friend of hers who lives in Kankakee. And we exchanged letters for about 2 years, and she invited me to come meet her and her family in the Philippines. This would have been 91, I think, or 92. I don't know. You could call that a mail order bride, I guess, but I don't know. It's kind of a demeaning term. She spoke a number of languages. She was real resentful of any idea that I might have been in the military and that this is how she became my wife. She sort of felt, and I don't know if this is common among Filipinas, that women marry American servicemen are sort of like morally compromised or something like that. That absolutely was not the case with Tita. She was of the utmost, highest moral character.
Bart started out working as a dishwasher at Red Lobster.
Worked at a number of nursing homes. I was assistant kitchen manager of Westminster Village Nursing Home, which isn't a nursing home. It's a retirement home, very large retirement home. I supervised probably 40 people, and then I had just been hired at Applebee's.
What did you aspire to? What did you want to do before all this happened?
That's the problem. I didn't have a whole lot of ambition. I didn't look to the future. I was a loafer, basically. I was not ambitious. I was more concerned about what I was going to be doing this weekend with my buddies than I was 2 or 3 years from now.
By his own admission, Bart was not a faithful husband. While his wife was pregnant with Christina, Bart began an affair with Masuk Nolan, who was also married at the time.
It was Halloween in 1994. Well, actually, this is the first time we consummated our relationship. A few times prior to then, probably earlier in October, maybe once or twice in September, we had met a couple of times and had lunch together. I think I took her to a couple of nightclubs. She had not really been exposed to the nightlife scene in Bloomington prior to that. And she and I had both gone to Chicago a couple of times. She took me to Korean restaurant, and she shot the little Korean grocery stores and stuff, and go to the Korean beauty salon. And so we sort of did this for about a month or so, and sort of eased into it at first. And after about a month, we sort of formally consummated the relationship.
How do you sort of consummate a relationship? What exactly happened?
Okay, we did the nasty. I mean, her husband worked third shift at the tire factory, Bridgestone, and she gave me directions to her Hayworth farmhouse about 10 miles outside of Bloomington, and I drove out there one night, and actually it was a couple of times, and spent some time with her at her home while her husband was away. I think it was probably on the third time or so that we, my third visit to her, that we finally had relations at her home.
So who was the instigator?
It was mutual. I mean, we were sort of leaning that direction for a month. I mean, she really liked me, and I really liked her, and I didn't formally say, you know, hey, let's do this or anything like that, but as our late night phone conversations progressed and our, you know, lunch dates and a couple of other informal dates progressed, it was just not something that we, you know, spoke of, or one side or the other said, hey, let's do this. It was
sort of aimed a pass, as it naturally does, between two people who are equally attractive to each other.
Did your pregnant wife know what was going on?
Yes, she did. I don't remember when it was, probably in November or so, a month or two later, that I did confess to her what I was doing and confess to her that I was intending to eventually leave her and begin a new life with Masuk, as Masuk did with her husband, Andy Nolan. She was devastated. Who wouldn't be? And I'm very much ashamed of what I did then. And I'm not making an excuse or anything. I was just weak-minded, weak at heart, morally compromised, whatever you want to call it, flawed in every way to have even considered doing that. But I was under her spell. I mean, I was almost helpless to her ways and her charm, of Masuk, that is. And I was willing to take it all the way and go through the process of a divorce and begin a new life with Masuk, as she was with her husband, Andy, and of course she had a kid of her own. That's sort of the way it happened.
What was the deal here, Bart? Were you thinking with your penis?
Yes, partly, but no, not entirely, because, you know, I genuinely was, you know, emotionally attracted to her on, you know, across the board. But, I mean, that was probably part of my initial, you know, motive for wanting to get with her, but I'm not going to handcuff this. I genuinely loved the woman at the time, at the beginning of our relationship. And even as it deteriorated, ironically, these are two cliches you probably hear a lot of. As a male, you might be able to relate to them, but prior to becoming married, you know, I was not intensely active with females, but it wasn't until I got married that all of a sudden, women that I would have gladly dated prior to becoming married, all of a sudden wanted to be with me. And Masuk happened to be the one that sort of hit all my right buttons. And as our relationship continued, while, you know, I began to realize what a huge mistake I had made in tossing aside my wife, who's a very good woman, an excellent mother, and a good wife, tossing her aside for this Masuk who ended up being a total monster. But that recognition of that did not come except for, you know, in the aftermath of Christina's death, or immediately prior to that. And even as the telltale signs, if you want to call them that, that I didn't recognize, sort of became increasingly apparent as she's sort of deteriorating psychologically, and these vindictive obsessions are just completely dominating her every thought.
Larry Mai said he wasn't surprised by his friend's conduct.
We kind of grew up in that time, you know, sex, drugs, rock and roll. You didn't pass up a piece of ass. And I'm certainly not wanting to discredit Bart by any means. I will forever think that he's innocent and got railroaded. But if you're telling me that he was having an affair while he was married, doesn't surprise me. But if you tried to tell me he was beating his wife or something like that, I'd tell you you're full of shit.
Another friend of Bart's is Jane Fairchild. She contends Bart would never physically harm another person. She still thinks of him as an innocent teenager.
We both were CB radio buffs. My name was Daffy Duck and his was Bugs Bunny, so we hit it off. That's how we met. We just started palling around with each other and doing fun things like going basketball games and going out to eat and goofing off and working on our CB radios. It's just not Bart to harm anyone. It was not who he is. And when my husband and I moved back to this area this past July, I hadn't heard from Bart for a long time because my husband and I married and we moved to New Mexico. And so I didn't really hear, you know, from people back in Illinois. But when we moved back to this area, I saw that Pantograph article about Bart in the paper. I think it was July. And I was reading it, and I said, Mark, I started crying. And I said, this is my friend Bart that I've told you about. And I started crying. And I said, that's not Bart. That's not who he is. He's the most sweetest guy I've ever known. That's just not his heart to harm anybody, let alone his little girl. He just was tender and gentle. I trusted Bart, and that says a lot for me.
Jane and her husband Mark have visited Bart in prison. She recalls their childhood friendship.
When I'd come over, they'd say, "Make yourself a sandwich, Jane. Make yourself at home." So Bart and I would just hang loose around there. Sometimes we'd even take a nap in the same bed, not doing anything. He was just an innocent kid, and he came from a good home. They were very kind to me as his friend. They embraced me, and Bart was always good to me, and I always felt like Bart was looking out for me, wanting to protect me. But his dad wasn't around a lot because he'd go to his classes and stuff. Bart's dad, I think, I'm pretty sure he was agnostic. Bart wasn't exposed to the Christian thing in life. But as he did remember, though, that he said, "That was the last time I saw you, Jane, was when you accepted Jesus and you went off your way." But I think Bart's, I don't know, the Lord's sending him special people around him. And Mark and I have even offered for him to come and live with us if he ever gets out, once he gets out, to help him get started. That's Mark and I, though. That's our heart.
Coming up next week during Suspect Convictions, a look back at Season 2, how Barton McNeil wound up where he is today, and also a look ahead at what could happen next in the effort to either exonerate Bart or grant him a new trial. That's next week during Suspect Convictions. Special thanks to Colin Thompson, WGLT General Manager R.C. McBride, and the production staff of Sound Ideas, including Mike McCurdy, Charlie Schlenker, and Ryan Denham. With investigative journalist and Suspect Convictions creator Scott Reeder, I'm Willis Kern. We'll see you next week on Suspect Convictions.